Good evening. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, U.S. President Barack Obama tells a Japanese newspaper his country opposes any unilateral attempts to undermine Japan's administration of disputed islands in the East China Sea. We look at safety in Bangladesh's garment factories and Hollywood's visual effects go global. It's all ahead on VOA's Crossroads Asia. Amid extraordinary security, President Obama arrived in Japan today at the start of an eight-day four-nation trip that will also take him to South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines, with security and trade issues among the main discussion topics. Washington criticized Prime Minister Shinzo Abe for his December visit to the controversial Yasukuni War Shrine, a symbol of Japan's militaristic past. Nearly 150 lawmakers made a similar visit Tuesday. Ahead of his arrival, Mr. Obama told a Japanese newspaper the dispute between Japan and China over uninhabited islands in the East China Sea is covered under a bilateral security treaty. He said U.S. policy is clear. The islands, known in Japan as the Senkakus and in China as Diaoyu, fall within the scope of Article 5 of the U.S.-Japan Treaty of Mutual Cooperation and Security. Mr. Obama said the United States opposes any unilateral attempts to undermine Japan's administration of these islands. Michael Kuchek, research associate of the Tokyo-based MIT Center for International Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty a president has never before been so explicit in his remarks about the issue.
That's something that has been U.S. policy ever since the islands were returned to Japanese sovereignty in 1972. But the issue of whether the security treaty covers these islands, which the United States feels is in dispute, the sovereignty over who owns them, the statement that the U.S. security treaty applies to them, and therefore if they are taken over by an outside force, we'll just say China, that the United States will respond militarily, is something that no U.S. president has ever said. Well, Mr. Obama has said it. That was job one in the eyes of the Japanese government. And that's been settled. Now everything is atmospheric. Since this is a state visit, the prime minister is not the host. The emperor is. And so there are many events that Mr. Obama will be attending with the emperor. And the emperor will be presiding over the state dinner, not the prime minister. So it's very much a ceremonial visit. It's the first one since 1996, since Bill Clinton paid a state visit. It's not really a business visit. But in so doing, it has tremendous symbolic value.
How would you characterize U.S.-Japan relations given Mr. Abe's visit to the Yasukuni Shrine in December, which was criticized here in Washington, and also the recent visit by dozens of Japanese lawmakers?
The visit in December was criticized by the United States immediately in a message released by the U.S. Embassy expressing disappointment, which came as a shock to the Japanese government. Disappointment sounds pretty mild in everyday speech, but in diplomatic speech, it's a real slap in the face. The repercussions of the strong U.S. reaction are still being felt and still being worked out in the Japanese political sphere. Should we be moving more toward the United States? Should we take offense at the U.S. being disappointed? These basic questions have not been answered by the ruling party within its own discussions or by the government. The visit yesterday by the lawmakers, the timing of Mr. Obama's visit is precisely when Yasukuni has its spring festival, and the cast of characters who went yesterday was exactly the same cast of characters who went last year at this time. One can only say that they at least had the decency to go before Mr. Obama arrived. The Shrine Festival is 3 days long. They got in and out of there fast. They were done before 9 o'clock in the morning. They tried to put some distance, even if it's only a few hours, between their acts and the arrival of Mr. Obama.
That's Michael Kuchek of the MIT Center for International Studies. Jeffrey Kingston, Asian Studies professor at Tokyo's Temple University, tells Victor Beatty the visit is seen as a symbol that the United States will not be distracted by events in Europe and the Middle East.
I think in Japan and the rest of the region, there's growing anxiety about China's regional hegemonic ambitions and the various territorial disputes that China has with its neighbors in the East and South China Seas. So I think that Obama's visit is mostly to reassure its regional allies and strategic partners that the United States is back, and that, you know, the perception of U.S. being distracted and neglecting Asia, he's trying to overcome that.
With the annexation of Crimea by Russia in Ukraine and the backing off of the Obama administration on threat military strikes against Syria, is there a concern in Japan that the United States isn't up to facing off against China?
Certainly the Japanese media have drawn attention to Crimea, and the events in Crimea cast a long shadow over Japan's territorial dispute with Beijing in the East China Sea. So I think that in Japan, they're looking for the United States to make a more assertive commitment about the alliance and security arrangements, and that the United States will come to Japan's aid if necessary. But Obama faces a very delicate balancing act. On the one hand, he needs to reassure his allies. On the other hand, he doesn't want to unnecessarily antagonize China. And so a lot of people have described this as mission impossible. It's really hard to do one without doing the other. So expectations are sort of low for this trip. I think that nobody's expecting a breakthrough in the Trans-Pacific Partnership talks. I think mostly it's going to focus on security issues. Obama will probably try to avoid making a specific reference to China. He will try to reassure Japan, and then on Friday when he goes to South Korea, reassure South Korea that, you know, America's back. But the problem is that Obama's rebalancing strategy really depends on its regional allies and strategic partners cooperating. And there's been a decided absence of cooperation between Seoul and Tokyo as they continue to rehash events of 70 years ago in unresolved historical grievances.
That's Jeffrey Kingston of Tokyo's Temple University. Earlier this month, a Japanese diplomat visited Seoul to discuss the sensitive issue of the sexual enslavement of South Korean comfort women during Japan's occupation in the 20th century. Key differences over compensation remain. Japan issued a public apology in 1993. In his newspaper interview, Mr. Obama said the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Negotiations, of which Japan is a party, is an important way for the United States and Japan to revitalize their economies. U.S. Trade Representative Mike Froman is in Tokyo as well, trying to bridge differences in bilateral TPP negotiations. Brandeis University professor Peter Petrie tells Victor Beatty he expects little progress, and both sides have erected barriers that will need to come down.
There are agricultural roadblocks for the Japanese. The prime minister has called these five agricultural products, rice, beef, pork, dairy, and sugar. He's called those sacred commodities that have to be protected. And the U.S. auto industry, in turn, is trying very hard to protect its markets because it feels that it's not getting much access to the Japanese market. So there are tariffs on U.S. cars. They're quite small. They're 2.5%. But there are very large tariffs on U.S. trucks, 25%, and SUVs, that is large passenger cars, really, count as trucks when they're imported in the U.S. So on both sides, there are these fairly big barriers, and they both are extremely sensitive politically. So my guess is that some progress will be made on these, but most likely, a final deal will only come when both countries understand that this is the kind of last chance. Now is the time that you have to make the deal. And if you don't make the deal, then it'll slip away from you politically. And that's not quite there yet, partly because the president, as you know, was unable to get trade promotion authority, that is negotiating authority, from the Congress, as he had intended to do earlier this year. So I think the Japanese will feel that maybe they're not quite ready to make this very painful compromise on their side when the deal on the American side is still a bit uncertain.
Well, interestingly, Japan and Australia reached a free trade pact not too far back.
Yeah, and the Australians don't have any of this problem of trade promotion authority and a very divided Congress, so that was part of it. The other part of it is that they had a much simpler negotiation, and they were willing to settle, frankly, probably for less than what the U.S. is. The U.S., in part, acting on behalf of other TPP countries, is willing to settle for. For example, in dairy products, New Zealand's participation very much hinges on the extent that the Japanese are willing to compromise. And if one cannot get a good agreement from the Japanese on dairy, then that part of the deal might unravel. So it's all very complicated. I think the Australians were very smart to do what they did, but it was much easier to do what they did than what the U.S. and the Prime Minister are trying to do now.
While Peter Petrie remains hopeful that an agreement on TPP can be reached among the parties this year, congressional approval in Washington, he says, won't likely occur before 2015. He says further delay into 2016, an election year, could be politically problematic. Well, meanwhile, China is voicing strong opposition to President Obama's statement that disputed islands in the East China Sea fall under a mutual security treaty between Washington and Tokyo. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
Commenting on the interview Wednesday, China's foreign ministry spokesman, Qin Gang, took particular aim at the U.S.-Japan security treaty, calling it a bilateral agreement formed during the Cold War. Qin says China is firmly opposed to putting the islands under the U.S.-Japan treaty, adding that the U.S. should respect the facts and take a responsible attitude, be discreet in word and deed, and play a constructive role in regional peace. The United States transferred administration of the islands to Japan in 1972, and Tokyo and Beijing have been locked in a dispute over them for years. In 2012, when the Japanese government purchased the previously private-owned and uninhabited islands, tensions began to rise even more. The U.S. has repeatedly said that it does not take sides in such regional territorial disputes. In his interview, Mr. Obama called for diplomacy and engagement instead of intimidation and coercion to resolve maritime disputes. The fight over the islands has become increasingly bitter ever since Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe stepped into office, and Beijing frequently puts all of the blame on Tokyo. China argues that the islands are part of its historic territory. Late last year, it abruptly and unilaterally announced the establishment of an air defense identification zone that includes the islands. Initial reaction to Mr. Obama's remarks was mixed. Tomohiko Taniguchi, a professor at Keio University and special advisor to the cabinet of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, says Obama's statement was historically significant.
It is the most reassuring statement that the nation has ever heard from the top leader of the biggest economy, biggest military power in the world. So nothing can be more reassuring.
In China, few saw the declaration as a shift in the overall U.S. position. Wang Dong, a political scientist at Peking University, says other U.S. officials have previously said the islands fall under this defense treaty. So the president's remarks are not a shift in policy. He said the remarks are unlikely to have any significant impact on the dispute and seemed more intended at reassuring U.S. allies in the region.
I really don't see this as something sort of a big surprise, you know, a 108% shift in U.S. Position.
Chinese state media, however, warned that the remark runs the risk of violating Washington's off-stated position, that it does not take sides in the dispute. One article by the China News Service said the U.S. should do more to promote peace and stability in the region instead of sending contradictory and false signals. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Coming up, visual effects in the films go global. Near Nearly 1 year after a deadly building collapse in Bangladesh killed more than 1,100 garment workers, efforts have begun to improve safety in the world's second largest supplier of clothing. But as Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, many of the victims' families are still waiting for adequate compensation, while hundreds of survivors are unemployed and coping with the trauma of that tragic day.
For the last 15 years, the owner of Bangladesh's Softex sweater plant, Rezwan Salim, had been manufacturing clothes in a rented building in Bangladesh's capital. But in early March, his booming business screeched to a grinding halt when international inspectors told him to stop work because the factory was not structurally safe.
I have no option but to evacuate. So that is what I've done. The building needs to be retrofitted. And the retrofitting, who is going to do it, who is going to pay for it, all of these issues are now being discussed.
The closure is a result of the Accord on Fire and Building Safety in Bangladesh, an initiative launched by 150, mostly European retailers, after hundreds of workers were crushed to death or injured when the eight-story Rana Plaza building collapsed a year ago. Although the factory on Dhaka's outskirts had developed cracks, workers were told to continue sewing clothes. It was the garment industry's worst ever disaster. The pile of rubble, which still sits at the Rana Plaza site, turned the global spotlight on the poorly built, unsafe workshops that churn out apparel sold by global retailers in Europe and the Americas. The collapse put pressure on multinational retailers to ensure that the garment factories producing their labels are safe. The tragedy has prompted key first steps to ensuring the protection of garment workers. The Accord has inspected about 300 of 1,500 buildings it plans to survey by September. Eight, including Salim's factory, have been completely or partly closed in an effort to avert another Rana Plaza type of disaster. The Accord is not alone in safety inspections, reviewing structural, electrical and fire safety systems. Another group of more than 20 American and Canadian retailers is leading a similar effort and has ordered one factory to close. The two initiatives have created confusion, but observers say the efforts are headed in the right direction. The executive director of the Accord, Rob Ways, sees the recent factory closures as an indication that change is taking place. But he admits that with much at stake for garment manufacturers, there is a measure of resistance.
I think in some ways, in many ways, though it's unfortunate, the requirement that suspension to production and evacuation of factory buildings is another indicator that progress is being made. There's a price tag on the fixes. And so there's been, I think, a little bit of anxiety and a little bit of an effort to try to push it back or slow it down.
Garment industry owners have expressed concerns about the expense of renovating buildings, saying the efforts could hurt Bangladesh's competitive edge and take business away to other Asian manufacturers. They want retailers to share some of the costs. Activists point out that fears that global retailers would reduce their footprint in Bangladesh in the wake of the disaster have not come to pass, and business has boomed in the past year. They are calling on garment factory owners to do more to improve the industry. Among them is Kalpana Akhtar, who heads the Bangladesh Center for Worker Solidarity.
They're shouting that we don't have money, or Accord is closing down our factory, or Alliance is closing down our factory. I think, you know, they just shouldn't shout that they don't have anything and they cannot make changes. Rather than do their own inspection and ship all those unsafe factories to SA buildings.
The global spotlight since the Rana tragedy also put pressure on government to improve working conditions for garment workers. The monthly minimum wage has been raised from $36 to $68. A law has been passed allowing workers to form labor unions. However, many feel that amid the focus on safety, the plight of those who were working on that fateful day in Rana Plaza has been overlooked. For hundreds of them, the nightmare continues. ActionAid Bangladesh has surveyed more than 2,200 family members of victims and survivors. The group's deputy director, Amanur Rehman, says many of them have not found alternate employment. The few hundred dollars they got as compensation from the government or welfare organizations has long been spent, and they need more money for food and to pay off outstanding house rent and loans. Rehman says many survivors are still coping with physical injuries or mental trauma suffered on that fateful day.
Many of them still they have a kind of phobia to work in a closed environment. Some of them are still suffering from insomnia. Some of them are sometimes shocked by sudden louder sound or something like that. So these kinds of trauma still make them panic to come back to their regular life.
The question is whether the Rana Plaza disaster will become a turning point and ensure that the nearly 4 million workers in the industry never have to suffer a similar fate, or will it be business as usual? Anjana Pastricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Many Hollywood movies include stunning visual effects. Most of those effects used to be produced in Hollywood, but that's changed. Now one film can include visual effects produced in different countries. Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles.
Tommy Williamson is passionate about filmmaking. As a former visual effects supervisor, he worked on many Hollywood blockbusters, but not anymore.
It kind of breaks my heart to have to leave the whole thing. In fact, I don't even say that I left. I said it left me.
New technology means visual effects can be made anywhere in the world, and Hollywood films are including work from other countries. Venkatesh Radham is chief executive officer of India-based Reliance Media Works.
In the last 5 to 7 years is where you've seen an explosion of actually content getting processed in different parts of the world, not just India, but be it China, Taiwan, Korea, India. These are all markets that content from Hollywood is going to.
While countries such as India offer lower costs, what is even more attractive to studios are countries that offer financial incentives for work to be done there. And that's driving work out of Hollywood, says Dave Rand, co-founder of the Association of Digital Artists, Professionals, and Technicians.
I've been at 12 different visual effects companies, been on the staff of 5, all of which have gone bankrupt for one reason or another. Basically, there's only two. The way we work and the subsidy race has driven so many of them out of business.
The association's other founder, Daniel Lay, says the solution lies in the U.S. federal courts.
The United States government puts very strong anti-subsidy laws that have been around for years that allow for domestic industries that are being injured by these international subsidies to seek relief through the trade courts.
He wants a tax levied on work produced outside the U.S. Reliance Media Works' Venkatesh Radham does not think that's a good idea.
It's not a progressive idea. You are actually artificially pumping up the cost. You're limiting talent availability.
Radham says currently, Hollywood can draw from an international talent pool. It's benefiting artists like Kunal Chandarkar, who works on Hollywood movies from Singapore for the visual effects company Double Negative. He spoke to VOA in a Skype interview.
Hollywood movies are probably shown all over the world, and a lot of people watch those movies more than Bollywood and all the Chinese movies. Also, like when you work on those, you learn a lot of new things as well. But the people that are working with me right now in Double Negative are from all over the world. And like we have people from Australia, from UK, from France.
Venkatesh Radham says working with Hollywood improves the quality of work worldwide. He says the key to a visual effects company's survival is to also branch out into other areas of filmmaking. He says firms also need a presence in countries where the work is done, and that includes the U.S.
You cannot survive in this marketplace without a physical presence here. So from that perspective, companies like ours will continue to create American jobs in America, rather than actually think about how much of this work is going to Canada or UK or India or China.
He says the visual effects industry will continue to evolve, and those who want to stay in the business will have to continue to adapt. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Thank you.